This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's really great to be with you all tonight to talk about social connection and healthy aging and successful aging in general. And so here are my disclosures and the funding from some of the work that I'll be presenting tonight. So I always like to start my talks with a quote. And this one I liked because it evoked the difficulty of answering some of the questions that we'll be trying to address tonight, which is that perhaps the secret of living well is not having all the answers, but in pursuing unanswerable questions in good company, which I certainly believe you all are. So these are the questions I'll be answering tonight or working on answering, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these. But the first one is, what is the impact of social connection on healthy aging, and how do we know what we think we know about it? What in the world and what the heck is happening with social connections given the pandemic and all the changes that we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years? And related to that, what can we do as a society as well as for individuals to increase social connection? But the first thing to start with is from a science standpoint, really to think about what we mean by social connection. And this is from a Surgeon General report of loneliness, and it's derived from work from Holt Lundstad and colleagues. And it really divides social connection into three pillars. And that would include the structure of your relationships, the function of those relationships, and then the quality of those relationships. So structure would be the amount of people you live with, if any, the number of partners you have at work and other places. So just the raw statistics of your social network. The function has to do with the degree to which you provide something to others or others provide things to you. And then the quality includes things like how you feel about those relationships. We all know people who could be lonely in a crowd, and then there are others who'd be perfectly content on a desert island. And so these aren't, they're highly correlated with each other, but not completely overlapping. You might have heard of lots of other terms like social support, social network, social isolation, loneliness. These are often used in popular media and others. And really what I've tried to do here is kind of map them onto these different dimensions. And we'll talk about research that focuses on these constructs in the next little bit. Before we get to that, I would also like to get at it because I really focus on measurement a lot. How do we measure all these things? Well, by far the most common approach is through self-report questionnaires. So asking people, how often do you feel lonely? How many relationships do you feel that you feel satisfied with and so forth on questionnaires? But we can also ask about the people that you have in your life and then how those individuals are related to one another. And from that, you can actually paint a network, a social network from somebody's life and then understand how those connections change with age. What I do a lot of is ask people not just in general how you feel, but I ask people through mobile devices, how are you feeling right now and who are you with right now? And from that, we can stitch together data about people's everyday experiences and look at trends within days and across days through fancy statistics. We can also, with your permission, track things like how many calls you make in and out. And really, our digital phones and smartphones are providing an immense resource for research around social connection these days. And there are also other dimensions like how well you are able to participate in social abilities or social interactions. And then your voice and the way you talk and what you talk about also carries information about communication that maps onto this question. So what does change with social connection with aging? Really, the most prevalent theory, and it's been highly supported in the data, is the convoy theory and this idea of socio-emotional selectivity. Those are long words, and I'll explain what they mean. Really, it is that when you're in younger adulthood, you accumulate a lot of connections, and the size of these circles represents sort of the number of people or connections you might have. On the outer ring are people that are part of your sphere, but maybe aren't people who are closer friends or associations that you have. And then there's a core group in the middle. And what we do see with aging is that social networks do decline. They shrink. But the middle, the core, actually stays about the same size. And in essence, this is kind of the convoy that you travel with throughout your life. Obviously, this becomes problematic if people in that core pass away or are no longer available. But by and large, this is how older adults really kind of optimize their social network energy and maybe get rid of some of the people that aren't really doing much for them. So this is really a healthy, seen as a healthy phenomenon and a normal phenomenon. So really what I think is fascinating is that the data suggests that really the middle solution where engagement with your preferred partners is the most common thing that stays stable, but the network size and the total social engagement that you have might decline. What's really fascinating to me is that this figure and these data are actually not coming from humans, they're coming from research on monkeys or macaques specifically, which are in Asia. And what those monkeys do is exactly like humans. They spend, as they age, more time or maintain their energy and their devotion to their preferred partners, and they spend less time with people that are more at the periphery. So I think what you might hear a lot of in the literature when you hear about things like loneliness in aging is that it is an epidemic that's specific to older people. And in reality, actually, if you follow older people over time, this is from the US Health and Retirement Study, which follows 20,000 Americans throughout their multiple age bands. What they found is that actually the rate of loneliness in that population declines when you follow people. That's both periodic loneliness, which is, you know, occasional feelings of loneliness, which as well as chronic loneliness, which is more feeling lonely more or less all the time, which is really something that we would be concerned about, that actually seems to decline as well. So maybe in contrast to popular opinion, older adults maybe have less loneliness, but also smaller social networks on average. So then your next question, or our next question, is how does social connection affect your health? There are lots of studies that follow this. And what this is a forest plot, which is something that's used in studies that aggregate lots of findings across different studies. And just showing you how to read these things, there's a bar in the middle and the dots refer to effects that are taken from individual studies that are the rows. And as you can see, all the dots are mostly on the right side of the bar in the middle, which indicates greater risk of mortality. So this meta-analysis and many others have found that social isolation is related to early mortality, or flipping that, lack of social isolation is related to longer life. So a big question that you should ask is, well, okay, that's a study or a set of studies, but how do we couch this into something that relates to other health behaviors we know a lot about? And we'll talk about this a little later, but the whole understanding of social connection as a dimension of health is actually a pretty recent phenomenon. I think we're still not sure how to measure it and what to do about it. But if you compare the study that I just showed you with other kinds of findings that pertain to health behaviors that we all know are difficult on your body, like smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day, drinking 6 alcoholic drinks a day, being inactive, being obese, or having air pollution, the social connection, lacking social connection, in a sense, is more severe in terms of its effect on longevity and is equivalent to about smoking a pack a day. So that sort of helps couch this focus on social connection in terms of its importance to human health. So it's not just longevity. We're also interested in things like cognitive health. And there have been a variety of longitudinal studies that have followed people over time in various different countries where there are different social structures and different social norms. And so what they've consistently found is that things like feeling lonely or having no monthly or weekly interactions with family or friends are related to greater risk of mild cognitive impairment as well as dementia. So there is a big interest now in how these social connections relate to brain health as well. And there are also a lot of studies on other aspects of health, including mental health and also physiology. So I think another question that is important to ask is, how does disconnection or social connection impact health? And there are three really kind of main mechanisms. Again, this is from the US Surgeon General report, which is quite good on this. But really, it's a combination of biology, which would include things like inflammation. The more lonely one is and more socially isolated one is, that's a sign to the body to increase inflammation, which has other downstream effects. There's also things like meaning, purpose, and hopefulness, and things that are protective against health in general that are also influenced by social connection. And then there's really indirect effects, because social connection or lack of connection is related to things like poor nutrition, poor sleep, and other health behaviors. And I'll show that on the next slide. So this is a study examining social isolation, loneliness, and health behaviors at older ages, where they followed people over time and measured multiple aspects of these social as well as health behavior constructs, and found that social isolation was related to increased alcohol use, less exercise, and worse diet, whereas loneliness was also related to increased risk of sustained smoking. So really, a remarkable amount of data is accumulating about the effect of social connection and social disconnection on health. What are we doing at UCSD, and what am I doing? And so I'm involved in a couple of studies, or a couple of domains of studies that focus on social connection. And I'll talk about those. But the big questions for those are, how does disconnection influence steps in healthcare and help seeking? And how can we use new technologies to measure social processes, particularly in older people? So I'm going to focus the next couple of slides on suicide prevention. And I know this can be a triggering topic for some, but I think it's really relevant to help seeking. And so first want to talk about data from the really a data set that focuses on people who died by suicide, and tries to understand what were some of the risk factors that accompanied that. And what we see is that 75% of older adults who did die by suicide did not tell anybody about that prior to their death. They're also less likely than younger people to leave a suicide note. And they're also less likely when alive to use the crisis line, to reach out for help, such as through the crisis line, at least at the VA setting, is a study that we completed. Another thing that we're particularly interested in documenting at the VA is, okay, when people are experiencing a crisis, the best thing to do for them is to set up a safety plan. And so we might ask them to plan ahead and think about warning signs that they might follow related to their mental health struggles, things that they could use to cope, and then also social contacts, other people that they could reach out to that could provide either a distraction who may offer help, perhaps before they reach out to urgent care services. And so we looked at veterans at the VA here in San Diego who endorsed having active suicidal thoughts and who'd completed a safety plan. And we were interested in what the boxes that people filled in around social contacts said and related in particular to those who weren't reporting any social contacts. And we were struck by the fact that 30% of people lacked anybody to put in their social category for these safety plans, which, you know, I think one could step back and say, is that really a helpful safety plan at large? But it did seem like men in particular and Caucasian men in particular were more likely to lack these listed contacts. And what we found is that by and large, that having fewer or no contacts was related to a higher risk of having a later suicide attempt at 1 year, and also being engaged in urgent care services for suicidal thinking. So this is an example where social connection or social disconnection is really, in a sense, interfering or potentially really fostering suicidal behavior. And so what do we make of these missing social contacts, and why don't people disclose these thoughts? I think a big question, just thinking back to those safety plans, is it because people lack contacts, or do they just don't, or do they have people that they could reach out to but choose not to? And if they do have people that they could reach out to but they don't want to, is it because they are afraid it won't be helpful, or are they avoiding it? And then how does this all mix with the really troubling scenario that people who basically have more severe symptoms are less likely to seek help? So I think there's a whole bolus of research that we're doing that's focused on social networks and disclosure in older adults who are at risk. And so I get to collaborate with really brilliant people here at UCSD that focus on measuring social health through in a very interesting social affiliation paradigm, as also understanding people's social networks and how they think about their networks in terms of crisis. And we're going to follow people over time and really try to understand what drives people towards and away from seeking help. Related work, actually supported by the Stein Institute, is also using mobile phones to try to understand the day-to-day experiences of things like loneliness in older people. What we did was ask people on a frequent basis, how are you doing right now? How lonely are you? How anxious? How happy? And so forth. And from that, we can stitch together what we call networks that tie together these experiences. And from this study, I can simplify it by suggesting that feeling lonely is connected to lots of things in the everyday experience of older adults. And in particular, it does seem to relate to, at least in healthy older adults, the desire to go outside and leave one's house. And one could imagine when people were told not to go outside that this might have caused additional problems. But so I think from modern data collection techniques, we can really learn a lot about the sequences of behavior. We can also learn a lot from what people say, too. Another great colleague of mine, Varsha Badal, has been applying natural language processing and speech analysis to transcripts of older adults talking about their experiences and their some interesting findings that the way people talk is, in particular, the use of things like first-person pronouns, like we, is related to lower degrees of loneliness. This does not mean that you should stop using the term or start using the term we more often, but it does suggest that there might be other ways that we can help monitor people that we might not be able to reach before with questionnaires and other means. And so to all this, we're also examining things like loneliness and social isolation interact with not just Alzheimer's disease itself, but also blood biomarkers of risk. And so with Eric Granholm, we're working on a project that is collaborating between UCSD and the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center here on a study supported by the National Institute on Aging. And there again, we're including daily questions and also social network measures. And so I really look forward to coming back one day and to summarizing some of those findings. But just up to this point, just know that social connection has several dimensions with many different measures. But regardless of how it's measured, really social connection has large effects on health and longevity. And we're trying to figure out new ways of measuring and understand measuring social connection and its impact on important junctures in help seeking, in particular in mental health. So next, I'd like to talk about what in the world is happening to social connections. So I think there are some really alarming trends in social connection that are happening nationwide and worldwide. These are data between 2003 and 2019, so right before the pandemic. But really rates of things like social isolation, household family social engagement, non-household family social engagement, companionship, people reporting engagement with friends have all been on the decline nationally. This is not just in older adults, but this is across age groups. If you're interested in the subject more, I think there are a lot of interesting resources that you can examine online that are becoming available as people become more aware of this topic. This is something called the Connect2Affect.org, which is monitoring state level and local level variation in social isolation and loneliness constructs. If you're in San Diego in the lower left corner, where less blue, darker blue means more social isolation. And so these new tools are able to generate information about where clusters of loneliness might be occurring and potentially what policies at the state or local level might be either able to prevent that kind of experience. So we all know that we just lived through a very challenging time that really affected people's degree of social connectedness or perceived connectedness, as well as objective connectedness. And so these are data from a 2003 a tracking poll that was performed by the University of Michigan that found that older adults indeed experienced a pretty rapid increase in feelings of social isolation that peaked in 2020 and then has gradually declined, although not quite back to pre-pandemic levels. So we're sort of, I think, still kind of coming out of a great experiment in enhanced social isolation. But here again, I think in contrast potentially to what you might read in the literature is that the degree to which these phenomenon are worsening in older adults compared to younger generations is an interesting contrast. So Dr. Twenge, who's at SDSU, has written extensively about social isolation and younger adults and the youngest generation. And there's just been remarkable increases in loneliness in the youngest population, which maps on quite well to data that indicates that the age group experiencing the greatest increase in mental distress is the youngest population. And then if you look at the rate of increase across the past 10 or so years, it follows this age curve such that the oldest substrata of this population, the US population, is experiencing the least amount of increase in mental distress compared to the younger folks. And I would be curious your opinions about why that is happening. So far with this section, I really wanted to convey that social connection trends are very disturbing and that the pandemic has increased social disconnection, but this impact has really lessened, at least for older adults in the data that we have available. And that really of the cohorts that raise the most concern nationally in respect to trends in social disconnection are really the youngest members of society. Not to say that there are many older adults that are experiencing loneliness and social isolation, but this is really on average at the population level. So the last section of this talk, I really wanted to focus on what can we do about this? What could we do that could increase social connection in society and then also for ourselves? So obviously the popular media, as well as people like the Surgeon General, as I've mentioned, as well as others are paying attention to this. So you've seen sort of large scale organizations like the World Health Organization, US and other major health organizations that have tried to address this with policy and opinion reports. There are also popular media approaches that are articles and books that have begun to address this topic. I really love and highly recommend this book, Bowling Alone, which was a phenomenon that never happened but has increased, but just sort of describing sort of the decay of some of the things that used to involve or used to be prevalent in people's lives that are no longer and that have maybe contributed to the decline in social connectedness. And then there are countries that are really emphasizing loneliness as a policy focus. And so the UK and Japan both have ministers of loneliness who really focus on policies surrounding social connection in their countries. So in general, if you look at these kinds of reports, a key question is what can society do to try to improve social connection? I think the kind of the summary findings from a lot of these studies include, or these reports include, that there is a need to support social programs or programs that help connect people in the communities that they live. And then also to invest in the built environment and reduce barriers to social connection. Obviously, if there are long crosswalks that older adults cannot cross to get to the other side of the street where the social activities are present, then that's a barrier in the built environment that needs to be addressed. And there are also innovations that can for new building that can also enhance social connection. And I'll describe one in a minute. We can also, I think, do better in healthcare, emphasizing social health and really assessing it as we would other aspects of your health and try to connect that with resources. I think another thing that countries are experimenting with is really limiting social media, especially for the youngest population, and addressing the role of social media in health. One thing at UCSD that we're excited about writ large is a new app that is being developed through the Center for Health Innovation that is focused on just this issue, is really sort of supporting social programs and making it very easy for incoming transfer undergraduate students and all the immense diversity of campus students here at UCSD to find out where they can meet others and connect with people that they want to connect with. And so this is a pilot phase of an app that we're really hoping it will help kind of transform the social health of our campus. But some really cool examples of solutions that have emerged that impact older adults include co-location or shared sites between older adults and childcare facilities. There are lots of benefits to this, to potentially to the childcare setting to give exposure to older adults and to multi-generational relationships. And then for older adults to be not sequestered into older adult specific areas. And so this is a solution that has been adapted and has been studied and does seem to have some positive effects on both populations and really represents kind of a win-win kind of solution for the built environment that might help reduce some of the barriers that are prevalent for social isolation and disconnection. Another thing that you might see in the near future would be social prescriptions. So there are models and toolkits now for primary care physicians to more thoroughly and directly address social limitations and isolation that their patients may have, and then have a whole toolkit and set of resources that might map onto social health as a dimension of health that would then be monitored just like other aspects of health. And so this movement, I think, will hopefully gain traction in the coming years. So what else can people do at an individual level to improve social connection? There are actually a lot of interventions that have been tried, and I will describe a few at UCSD in a minute, but they include things like social groups, like exercise, reminiscence, music, things where social isolation is kind of a byproduct of getting together to perform an activity. Social cognition interventions and cognitive behavioral therapy, which is some of the work that I do and others in our department do, which really get at some of the beliefs that people might foster that kind of interfere with their participation in social relationships, things like animals therapy, and then also technology-supported interventions as well. But then there are other more indirect interventions, which include things like helping older adults learn to use video conferencing or other technologies to be able to connect to loved ones from afar. And this was a particularly essential during the pandemic. And then hearing aids. So there's a huge literature on hearing loss and social isolation perceptions. And so hearing aids can really make a big difference in terms of social connectedness. By now, you should know that the big question you should ask is, do social interventions work? And so this is another one of those meta-analyses where the bar on the going up and down there represents a zero effect, and then to the left of that means a benefit or a reduction in a negative outcome like loneliness or social isolation. And I think the summary is that in general these interventions are I'd say effective, although they're certainly not as effective as social disconnection is bad for you at this point, but I think there's at least promise that interventions like animal therapy, counseling, exercise, things that combine these strategies are actually reasonably effective in improving these constructs, social connection in older adults in a variety of settings, including in long-term care and other settings as well. At UCSD and at the Stein Institute, we've done some really remarkable things. So I think in particular with Danielle and some of the other staff that have been here, have really developed brief interventions that focus on things like compassion and empathy, kind of building blocks for the opposite of loneliness, which would be in essentially feeling connected to others. And have shown that these interventions are feasible, acceptable, and really seem to have some short-term and some potentially long-term positive effects on things like loneliness. So there are digital health, by say digital health, web-based programs that are available to reach people in this topic that have been developed at Stein. We're also really interested in, by we, I mean Eric Granholm and myself at UCSD, are really interested in how we can use mobile phones to get at some of the differences in people's experiences when they're by themselves and at home versus when they're out in the world. We definitely think that people who are by themselves hanging out at home really need some reminders about things that they used to enjoy or do enjoy when they're out. And really would need to think about really having more balanced thoughts about the risks and downside of going outside and interacting with others. Whereas once people are outside of the house and they are interacting with people, figuring out ways to savor those interactions and increase the ceilings of them so that the next time they go out, they're motivated to go out. And so this is a blended intervention that includes both phone coaching as well as an app to be able to accomplish this. Everything need not be technology supported though. And so I think another project I'd really like to share with you is veteran specific. But this is really a project that is aimed at suicide prevention, but it is inspired by caring contacts. So these are a long-standing intervention that was developed in the 70s and still is really, I think to date, one of the only interventions that has shown to be able to reduce suicide death in a clinical trial. But it is simply where a hospital or a clinical system sends a contact to people who have left an inpatient psychiatric facility and says that contact really says simply, we care about you and we hope you are well. And please connect with us if you would like. So what a colleague of mine that I was fortunate to work with on this trial did was really add to this by having, instead of the hospital sending these contacts, developing a peer-centered group of veterans who previously had mental health concerns, including suicidal ideation, to create cards that they could then send anonymously to other veterans who were at current or recent urgent risk for suicide. And so really there's two groups here. There's veterans who are making cards that have a lived experience. And this actually have some examples of drawings that in quotes that were on these cards in the background of these slides. And there are cards recipients that received up to six of these cards once per month after a hospitalization. And what we found so far, and this is a pretty, low cost and it really just cost postage intervention. And what we found is that the people that receive these cards to date have endorsed feeling less or greater belongingness than they did at the beginning of the study, which really I think suggests that having veterans support other veterans and coming with unique ways to get them engaged provides some really really positive outcomes. I would say just to point out that we also, or Blair also developed a kind of a pilot to this where she had the card makers meet the card recipients as an optional aspect of the study. And it was very powerful that people were able to connect with the shared experience. And really, I think left some long lasting impressions because I think when we asked people about their experiences with receiving these cards and also creating them, it really seemed like it connected with them in a way that was pretty remarkable, even though it was a very simple intervention. So I just think this is a beautiful example of kind of a win-win, low-cost intervention that helps bring people together from kind of multiple sides of the equation and create something that was not there before, that some connection that was not there before. Okay, I just have a couple more slides and I would love to hear your thoughts on this topic. But I think that the big questions that pertain to this topic are many, because at this point, it is still not exactly clear what aspects of social connection are most important and for whom. Is it social isolation that's more important, or is it loneliness? And how do each of those kind of dimensions interact with brain health, with physical health, and all of the other aspects of health that we monitor? And at least from my interventional experience and probably naive scientific standpoint, that we could target this topic and really make a change in individual lives, I've just found that social connectedness is actually something that's pretty tough to change. People's social routines and social habits and social networks tend to get pretty stuck, I think, and getting people to make a sustained change in that area is difficult. One of the reasons why I think this is because there really isn't a specific, to date anyway, marker or goal point for a social activity like there is for physical or activity or diet. So as an example, if I said, which I'm not going to actually do, but if I said I'd give you $1,000 if you started to exercise or you started to develop a healthier diet, you probably would come up with some ideas pretty quickly for things you could do or might do to improve. However, if I asked you the same question about improving your social health, or even something harder like making two new close friends, that's a lot more challenging. So I think my overall point here is that I think we should be patient and very persistent. And then I think very creative about ways of trying to intervene on this and assume it's not going to be a problem that's easy to solve. The last real challenge, and I think tonight's digital lecture is probably an example of this, it's really still not quite clear what the value equivalence of virtual or digital health interactions is compared to in-person. Is texting the same thing as speaking to somebody on the phone versus meeting somebody in person in terms of its influence? And how do we really characterize social activities and what do we encourage in thinking about this as a health behavior? I would say that at least in psychotherapy research, there really hasn't been a clear signal that psychotherapy through telehealth is any worse than in person, but I think it's just still an open question. So really to conclude here, I think the take home points from this talk are that social connection is really vital to healthy aging. It is one of the key pillars to aging well. And I think sits alongside diet, physical health, and cognitive health, and just as an important pillar as those. And as I just sort of try to exemplify, it is tricky to measure, and then it is even trickier to try to improve. And so I think we should respect it and be patient with interventions that are tested. And then if you're trying to improve social connection, I think being patient with the process as well. I would say that there are definitely some troubling trends, and so the time to talk about this as a society is definitely now, because there are some really particularly troubling trends, particularly in the youngest generation, who incidentally also will become the older generation at one day too. So I think these trends are something that we really need large scale approaches to addressing. And then there are many creative approaches, including here at UCSD, to measuring and improving social connection. And really, we need more of them, and we need your ideas as well in this society-wide problem. So with that, I just want to say thank you so much for all of your attention in this talk and for joining this. And I'd really be curious about your thoughts on this. I put my email here, and I would love to also talk to anybody. I know we're going to have a Q&A, but please feel free to reach out, and I would love to talk to anybody about this topic. So with that, I will close.
Thank you so much, Dr. Depp. That was fantastic. We have a lot of questions in the Q&A, so I thought we could just go ahead and jump right in. You ready to go?
Sure.
Okay. What would you suggest for older adults who have become agoraphobic in recent years, fearful about leaving their home?
Yeah, so I think this is really relevant to the pandemic and to sort of what people got used to, and so I think you know this would evoke the question that their doctor should know about this, and that I think it is a health behavior that that does cause some risk. I think it's sort of. So I think for that person, what might be recommended would be that they, you know, treat it as a health issue and work with their health providers to try to identify potential solutions for things that they would be willing to do. I think if it's your friend, I think anything that might get the person to maybe get out of the house or to be connected and to continue to be patient with them, to reach out to them, I think would be great advice. And if there's anything that they used to like to do that they could be enticed to leave. I do think that this is a phenomenon that's pretty common and is I think all too common. And so I think being patient with the person and trying to entice them out of their room is really helpful. There are you know, psychotherapists and other people that would be helpful, I think, potentially in addressing this issue more deeply in terms of anxiety, but really, the best kind of anxiety focused treatments are those that involve exposure. And so if to getting out and getting used to being out again and having a graduated approach to sort of being back out there. So.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Here's a question we see a lot with older adults. So bereavement and loss of a partner can have a substantial impact on a person's social interactions. Other than joining a grief support group, what strategies for reintegrating into social circles do you have?
Yeah, I think there's this is a great question, and I think that I think there's obviously no roadmap, I think, for a lot of people in terms of thinking about what to do after the loss of a spouse or somebody who's really close. Obviously, bereavement support groups would be a great suggestion, I think, in respect to not feeling alone in that experience. But I think. Really, I think it's kind of the similar set of advice where really trying to connect formerly enjoyed activities in some way and experiencing those activities in a graduated fashion and trying to build those in and, you know, making a concerted effort. And then, you know, if you're really struggling with doing that, I think giving yourself grace and, you know, asking for help to do that. From therapists or from, you know, clergy or whomever you trust to help you really kind of redefine what your next steps in terms of social health are.
Yeah, thank you for that. Can we discern the types of social connections that are more impactful? For example, is there a difference between playing bridge with random people versus mentoring young people or chatting with strangers at a cafe? Like any difference between, say, also any difference between, say, virtual versus in person?
Yeah. And that's sort of where I think I was getting at. It's not like exercise or something like that, where, you know, there are some data about how many steps you should take and sort of a marker. I would say that I think all of those examples are good. And I think that, you know, if I think one additional, I would sort of be thinking a little bit about whether they provide any bonus additional benefits in terms of your mental health. So being a mentor to others does provide, you know, personal meaning and satisfaction in that respect. And so if there are activities that are kind of killing two birds with one stone, I think, you know, those might be better. But as far as what data would be able to tell you which one is going to allow you to live longer, I really don't think there's a database answer to that. I just might prioritize ones that are more connected to some meaningful experience in your life if they add some other benefit to you. You know, obviously playing pickleball or doing something physically active and socializing. So these kind of multi-component interventions that kind of hit both multiple aspects of your health at the same time might be better, but that's, I think, difficult to to really discern from the literature. I don't really think that there's a whole lot of evidence at this point that digital or virtual video calls versus being in person have a different impact on health in terms of well-being. So I don't think there's enough data to suggest that there's a deterrent there from choosing one or the other. It's really kind of more your preference.
Yeah, which sort of ties into the work that we did with the resilience intervention. What we found is that so long as the activity was associated with value-driven activities, right? So the activities that you were doing were sort of in alignment with what your values are. So if your value is spending time with friends playing bridge or doing mentoring, like if so long as there's alignment, you'll have better health outcomes. So thinking about that, like sort of thinking about what your values are and how can I do activities that sort of align with those things.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So this is something that's, you know, what your values are things that are quintessentially you. They're not, you know, if that existed as far back as you remember. So I think, you know, if you feel like it connects to one of those, then I think that probably means you're on the right track.
Yeah, exactly. So this is more of a statement than a question, but it does tie into the last piece of what you were just talking about, which is, it seems like people are using social media in place of in-person social connections, and especially since during and after the pandemic.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting research actually out of UCSD on social media use. This was pre-pandemic that looked at the relates of I forget what the outcome, if it was health or mortality, but what they really sort of suggested, this was James Fowler did research that suggested that people who are on social media that are using it to showcase, hopefully not show off, but showcase experiences they had in the outside world, or using it to connect, and they're actually posting and talking to others, generally experiencing some well-being benefit from that. I think for people that are lurking and not sort of passively viewing it and or replacing other activities that they would normally have done, I think then that becomes more toxic actually than not. So I think that's the concern, and particularly with younger people, that it's sort of supplanted some very fundamental aspects of social connection that they normally would have had, and that's sort of might be what's driving some of these increases in mental health. That causal relationship is very hypothetical, but I think there's accumulating data in that domain.
Okay, great. Okay, so here's a question on research on the influence of culture on social connection. So is there any research out there that sort of shows whether or not culture has anything to do with how much or how little social connection is needed?
Yeah, I think that is why, well, at least one of those studies I shared did look at international cohorts. And so there is interest in looking at social connectedness, experienced by different cultures that follow older adults over time. So, and pooling those data together and looking at, you know, whether studies in Asia or Africa or the European Union produce the different results. I think that the association between social connection is, you know, and health outcomes is pretty similar across those. So that, you know, there's positive effects of social connection. I think as far as how culture, in particular, culture and aging influence social isolation and loneliness. I think that's a whole nother can of worms in a sense, and I think relates to sort of how the, you know, the built environment and how where people live, who they live near, mm-hmm. you know, whether, for example, whether people live in multi-generational housing or that sort of thing. So there are some real significant influences of culture that people certainly do study at UCSD and anthropology and other groups.
Okay, great. So we had a question come in that is sort of adding to or following up on the question that we had earlier about the type of connection, like whether it's like a deep connection or just a chit chat, superficial connection. based on your answer, they're asking, so does that mean we don't know that deep social connection is any better than a superficial connection?
No, I think when we think back to that convoy theory slide that I showed, I think the idea is that that core group of people that are your closest folks that provide emotional support and that provide instrumental support and that you provide support to are really the piece that is what's most protective for health and really what older adults in general kind of protect as they naturally age. There's lots of data that indicate that just having a single confidant. And so I think one point is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to just build a gigantic social network and be close friends with everybody, but really studies that have shown that having a single confidant can be protective for cardiovascular health and other things. So I do think that, you know, the relationships that you have, the close relationships are vital to that. I would say as far as social activity and what counts as social isolation is a different matter. So whether, you know, having chats with strangers is impacts your health or not is an open question. But I think having close relationships is absolutely vital to health. Whether you know, how often you talk to them or connect with them is another story.
Okay. And here's an interesting question I think we could ponder a bit. Is loneliness from grief, like losing a spouse, different from wanting relationships that hasn't happened?
Yeah, I think kind of. It is experiencing a discrepancy between your desired and current social connection. Mm-hmm. And I think people have described it as sort of an aversive state that is probably hardwired into us to try to convince us to be more socially connected. I think in a sense, it is representing an experience of a loss or a lack of something. And so in some ways, loneliness is a form of grief, I guess you could say. It is also, you know, for some people meant to be also motivating. So it might tell people to participate in other activities or reach out to others. So it's not always a bad thing, but I think the idea when it's chronic and it's sort of stuck on the on position, just like something like stress, which does take a toll.
Okay, great. So we have time for one more question. And I think this is the perfect question to end on today. What are some daily practices that people could use to improve social connections?
Great question. Yeah. So I think on a daily practice, I think I would really treat it as a priority and think about who you're spending time with that day. And then really, I'd say prioritize the activities that you have, discretionary activities and others to maintain those connections. So I think reaching out to people that, you know, maybe you haven't talked to or that sort of thing, I think is really healthy, and sort of maybe treating it as something that is something you kind of monitor. How healthy are your relationships, and is there anything you can do to prevent worsening of them or improve them? I think, you know, so I think on a daily practice, you know, being engaged in activities that have a social dimension does seem to be important. So, and if you're not doing those things, don't beat yourself up about it, because I think, I do think that really having a casting a wide net for things that are linked to your interests and your values should yield you some opportunities that you'll like and want to engage in.
I think that's a great way to end things. Well, I want to really, truly thank you today for your talk, Dr. Depp. It was fantastic. I learned so much, and I'm sure that everybody on the call did today too. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. A reminder that you can support our work by seeing us at aging.ucsd.edu. Thanks, Dr. Depp.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.